Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Mike Pesca, in for Brian Lehrer. My next guest is here to talk about a book with a benign title that does little to prepare you for the truly scary stuff inside. Jane Gross's new book, A Bittersweet Season, Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves, is out from Knopf. It's a memoir of taking care of her aging parent and a guide for the rest of us to the medical, familial, spiritual, and bureaucratic crises that are so often a part of death and dying today. You might follow her reporting on the New York Times and the blog she created called The New Old Age. And we would like to hear from you. Do you have your own experience to share as a parent or the child of an aging parent? What did you learn and what did you wish that you had known? So wisdom is appreciated here at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Jane Gross joins me now to share some of what she learned. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Joe.
Mike, but you start...
Forgive me.
You start your book with the rock and the hard place that many of us who had parents in failing health find themselves. It's the question of when to intervene. If you do it too soon, you could humiliate the parents. If you wait too long, it's unmanageable. What kind of guidelines can you give us on that question?
Mostly to pay very close attention and talk about it as much as you can with them before the crisis, whatever the crisis is, so that you're not trying to figure out what to do totally from scratch in the midst of something scary happening.
I think underlying everything in your book is the concept that maybe we're too slow to recognize there is no such thing as old age. It's different stages now more than ever, right?
Yes, certainly that's true.
And so tell me about your mother and what were, you know, her stages of post-retirement and aging.
Well, my mother sold a house on Long Island and moved to a retirement community in Florida when she was in her middle 70s and essentially fine. I mean, she liked not driving. She liked not shoveling snow. My brother and I liked the fact that there was a pull chain, you know, and somebody at the front desk if we called her. But a cane, a walker, you know, nothing to get excited about. And she had 7, 8, you know, really nice years there where I would say that we probably didn't pay as much attention as we should have. You know, we weren't regulars at doctor's appointments and things like that. And then a medical scare and we decided it was time for a reverse migration so that she could be closer to us, which I think is very common.
And this is common, especially here in the Northeast. The pattern, as you document, retirees go to Arizona or Nevada or Florida. They have a nice time for a little while, but then either there's a health change or they get very old. They want to be near family and family wants to be near them. And I think that in the whatever, the brochures for retirement communities or political discussions is just not at all examined. The reverse migration when people get very old and very frail.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think the thing that's least examined of all is how long and difficult a period of time there can be between essentially fine and, you know, forgive me for being this blunt, but dead. And depending on the trajectory any given parent takes, that could be 2 seconds and that could be 10 years. And none of us think about how we're going to manage that in between time.
So during the fine period, what should a child, an adult child, be doing?
During which period, I'm sorry?
The fine period, the time when they're first retired, having fun in one of these sunny states.
Well, I think that they should be developing some kind of relationship with whoever the parent's primary physician is, and which we didn't do. I'd never seen him. I barely knew who he was. And I think that we should have affirmatively provided my mother a lot of opportunities to talk about what she might want to do if and when, you know, that this was no longer the right place to be. I think that she had an easier time talking about it and would have had an easier time planning for it than we did as her children.
Did you say to yourself at the time, I don't want to bring it up, it might upset her?
No, I think...
It would upset you.
I think that, you know, we were quite happy with the status quo and that more than anything else, the kind of selfishness of everything's fine, you know, why rock the boat kept us quiet.
And we should add, biographically, your father passed away in 1973, I think.
Correct.
So that means your mom was a widow for many, many years. That, of course, could have changed things. Do you get into what happens when, you know, the health of different parents are at quite different stages?
Well, I didn't have that experience myself, but I certainly heard a lot about that during the period of time that I was writing the blog, and heard about it and see it with my friends. And frankly, I think it's the most difficult situation of all, because often the trajectory is going to be very different and the right decisions for one of them, it's not going to be the right decisions for the second.
You have said that, you know, you felt utterly unprepared for what was unleashed upon you. Of course, you analyze that you should have done things differently. We'll accept that. What about doctors, society, the medical community? What messages should have been out there that weren't?
Well, certainly no one, in my experience, ever really explains to you that Medicare is not universal health coverage for the elderly, which we all sort of grow up believing it is. And it is if what they need is a procedure, an operation, medication, you know, stuff done to them. Unfortunately, past a certain age, what they mostly need is what's sort of unattractively called custodial care, which is, you know, help getting around, somebody to spend a couple hours in the house, an assisted living community, a nursing home, a home health aide. And Medicare covers none of that. And I don't want to point a finger at who I think it is who's supposed to explain that to us, but I've never had anybody reach that juncture and not say, what do you mean Medicare doesn't cover it?
Yeah. And now Jane Gross is trying to explain it to all of us. A Bittersweet Season, Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves is the book, newly out from Knopf. Diane from NIAC, you've been through some of this. You're on WNYC, and go right ahead, Diane.
Hi. You know, I, in the past 2 years, actually gave up my home as an empty nester and moved in with my mother so that she could remain in her home and be as independent as possible, as long as possible. And it has been a very interesting experience in education for me. The child becomes the parent, and it happens in some ways very gradually, and in others it's just thrust upon you. Like, oh my God, you know, I'm the one who has to make the decision here. When you realize that a parent really isn't able to, and the reasoning skills are not there. So in some ways it's rather shocking. In other ways it's, I'm very grateful for this time. I tell my mother that every day that's a good day is a gift. It's a day that we have to know each other and be together. But I have not yet gotten to the point where she would need any kind of assisted living care. Nonetheless, I think the point of what I'm saying is It does require family to step back in and take the responsibility for their parents. You cannot depend upon institutions to do so.
Thanks for the call, Diane. And our number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. And Jane, you talk about that revelation or when your mother ceded the decision-making to you.
Listening to Diane was very interesting because I also found the last couple of years very rich in the getting to know each other department. My mother spent them in a nursing home and on a number of occasions refused to come and live with me. So I was kind of curious whether that was something that your mother was happy and glad to have or a struggle.
Well, we lost Diane, but we could set that out to other listeners and your own experience. Again, our number is 212-433-9692. Let's talk about the costs that we're talking about. How onerous are they?
They're staggering. In my family's case, and I didn't make any attempt to compute this until after my mother had died, and my guess is that it's an undercount. I also have no idea how my mother, as someone who was widowed at 58, accumulated this kind of money. But my mother spent almost $500,000 of her own money, and then in the last 8 months of her life, wound up on Medicaid, which picks all this stuff up essentially for the indigent. And there aren't really very many families that have $500,000 to spend on this.
And you by no means were a wealthy family.
No, by no means. Yeah, and, my brother and I spent money on, we didn't come close. I mean, my mother paid all the big ticket items. But, there's a lot of buy a television, buy a sweater, buy a six-pack of Snapple. I mean, you have to be really poor or a gazillionaire to get through this.
What about your brother? He had a different take on, or at least he experienced your mother's aging differently than you did.
I think he was fabulous, first of all. And I was often, when it was going on, self-righteous in the way that an older sister who is kind of a control freak is capable of being. I think that the one problem that I had and that I hear a lot from daughters is that when there are siblings of, two different genders, the tasks tend to break on very old-fashioned gender lines. And in our age group, we've all sort of grown up shedding that idea. And I spent a lot of time being mad that I was doing the sort of quote-unquote girl stuff and that the boy stuff must be easier when it would have been far less taxing for all of us if I had just said to myself how fortunate you are to have a brother who's carrying his half of the work, however it divides.
So when did you come to the realization? Because the timeline is your mother passed away in 2003. When did the blog begin?
The blog began in 2008.
And when did you start writing this memoir?
At the same time that I was doing the blog until I figured out my bandwidth wasn't wide enough.
But my question is, when did you, make peace with your brother's contribution?
I would say not for several years later. I mean, I made peace with it gradually, but it's important to say that in retrospect, my complaint, if you will, is more with my reaction than his behavior. And I think that part of that may be, and, you know, men would have to speak for themselves on this subject, I think that they're much better at compartmentalizing, and they're faced with a task. They do it, in my brother's case, extremely well, and then they resume the rest of their life. They don't walk around under a big black worry cloud all the time. So it may be that some of the resentment comes from wishing you had the capacity to do that.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. I'm speaking with Jane Gross, author of A Bittersweet Season, Caring for Our Aging Parents and Ourselves. Edward from Northport on Long Island, you're on the air. Hello, Edward.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'll give you a brief overview, and I'm very comfortable if either of you want to ask a question or interrupt in anything. I'm fine with that, so don't worry about it. My father died in 1980 at the age of 75. In 1987, my mother, who was approximately the same age as my father when he died, was becoming less able to take care of herself by herself. So we made an agreement to sell my mother's house, we sold our house, and we bought another house out in Long Island. We were able to, through a few changes, convert a one-family house into a mother-daughter type house, which worked very nicely, where she had her privacy, we had ours. She was a healthy person. She lived and drove a car well into her 90s. But as she aged and she became more dependent, we needed additional help. And so what we did was we went to our parish outreach program. You could do that with any faith, any religion. I'm sure there are others that are non-religious that also have similar services. They provided a list of people that were trustworthy that would come to the house to do various jobs. In the beginning, it was cooking a meal, doing some light housework, cleaning things up, and things like that. And my mother grew attached to all the people who came. And as things went on, eventually we had people come and live with us in our house on a live-in basis.
I don't know how long it takes, but the wisdom, the upshot, you know, a thing you learned from this was what?
Sure. As long as we're interrupting, yeah. I'm curious who paid for it.
Okay.
Okay, two ways. One was, incidental money came out of my wife and I. We're okay. My father was a good investor in the stock market, but I can tell you the cost. The cost averaged about $100,000 a year towards the end, which included having a person come in, room and board, having them live with us, and then all the other added expenses. That would be about an average cost for us. Yeah. In terms of personally getting through this, it was my mother. And so you typically have a mother-in-law problem. Well, that's why they have all the jokes about mothers-in-law. But my wife is a much better person than I am and much more understanding what you were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, how do men deal with it and how do women deal with it. My wife is a nurse and very understanding of the whole process that my mother was going through. Her mother died in a very healthy state in terms of... Yeah. On the obituary, when the doctor came, we got a doctor who made house calls. You can find those human beings. Usually it's a female doctor who has a husband who's making a good salary, and she decides to give her gift back by making house calls and taking whatever Medicare pays to come and
do. Did it surprise you at the outset that there was no insurance program, in this case Medicare, that helped you with any of these expenses?
No. I'm disappointed, but not surprised. So it would have been nice, because who wants to be dumped in a home? Not your own home, but dumped in a home. Do you know what I mean? All the research that's been done by other human beings, most people like to have familiar surroundings. They like to see the birds outside their window. They like all of the natural, normal things of life. When you're stuck in a cell and the people who are caring for you are the people that you always pay, it's not that people are cruel, but it's a business enterprise as opposed to a human enterprise.
Right. Edward, we do have to leave it there. We have a lot of calls. I want to thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
try, I'm sorry. Let's just try to get one in. And we talked about he was one of two men on the line, and there are eight women. Let's go with Maggie from Queens. Hello, Maggie.
Hi. So when I was 17, my mom got really sick. She was in a coma for several months, and I became her caregiver. It's been 15 years now, and I care for her as well as my grandmother, who's 101.
Oh,
and I have
God.
Them both at home. Jane, I actually met you years ago at the United Hospital Fund, something or other, I think.
Bless your heart, Maggie.
And Maggie, is her blog, is that something that everyone in your situation knows about and reads?
I definitely know about it, but I'm also involved kind of professionally and academically in the caregiving world. So, and it's something that I often find helpful and sometimes don't, because it's not that I don't find it helpful, but it's not tangible help, right? It's not somebody...
Well, also, you're 18 years old, Maggie, and you were not the target audience when I was writing nor for the person now.
Yeah.
You're very young.
And I think, you know, one of the big issues is that there are, you know, maybe 2 million kids under 18 caring for family members, and that's a huge issue also, and something that I've been active with. But I think that there's a lot of policy and advocacy work that needs to happen. I dream of taking my mother and grandmother and putting them on the steps of the Capitol and saying, you take care of them for a weekend and get back to me and let me know how that goes for you. And
can I come with you?
Yes. I think that everybody needs to, there's this, when you talk to caregivers, everybody says that they're isolated, but when you talk to people, you find that everyone has a story. And I think that that's really a powerful message, that everybody goes through this. And so we need to figure out a way to facilitate this and make it easier for people. And it's awful that there's no, there's no support for long-term care at home. Nobody pays for that. I personally save the federal government $300,000 a year. And I don't have health insurance for it, and I've not worked because I need to be home overseeing the care. So it's really complicated. And I'm really glad that you're on talking about it, Jane.
And, well, we want to thank you for the call. Thanks
Wow.
very much, Maggie. And finally, in the time we have left, I just want to ask you a question about the writing of this book. The genre is sort of a reported memoir. Would that be fair to call it that?
Yeah, I think my goal was to try to braid three things. One family's story, which is only one family's story. Reported advice, if you will, some of it which came out of the blog, some of it which came out of old-fashioned reporting.
Interviewing experts, and
And an explanation of how grievously flawed the public policy is and how much worse it's going to get when the baby boom generation is in need of this kind of care instead of providing this kind of care. We don't have a generation behind us as big as our own to do this.
Yep. A bittersweet season, caring for our aging parents and ourselves. The author and our guest today was Jane Gross. Thanks very much for coming in, Jane.
It was a pleasure.
In a moment, it is the anniversary of a landmark Supreme Court decision, and descendants of Plessy and descendants of Ferguson will be on to talk about their ongoing efforts to talk about civil rights. Stay with us.